You're listening to the Restless Wanderer podcast from Paul Coulter, and this is part 8 of a series in the book of Deuteronomy, Deuteronomy chapter 14. You are the sons of the Lord your God. You shall not cut yourselves or make any baldness on your foreheads for the dead, for you are a people holy to the Lord your God, and the Lord has chosen you to be a people for his treasured possession out of all the peoples who are on the face of the earth. You shall not eat any abomination. These are the animals that you may eat: the ox, the sheep, the goat, the deer, the gazelle, the roebuck, the wild goat, the ibex, the antelope, and the mountain sheep. Every animal that parts the hoof and has the hoof cloven in two and chews the cud, among the animals you may eat. Yet of those that chew the cud or have the hoof cloven, you shall not eat these: the camel, the hare, and the rock badger, because they chew the cud but do not part the hoof, or are unclean for you. And the pig, because it parts the hoof but does not chew the cud, is unclean for you. Their flesh you shall not eat, and their carcasses you shall not touch. Of all that are in the waters you may eat these: whatever has fins and scales you may eat, and whatever does not have fins and scales you shall not eat. It is unclean for you. You may eat all clean birds, but these are the ones that you shall not eat: the eagle, the bearded vulture, and the black vulture, the kite, the falcon of any kind, every raven of any kind, the ostrich, the nighthawk, the seagull, the hawk of any kind, the little owl and the short-eared owl, the barn owl and the tawny owl, the carrion vulture and the cormorant, the stork, the heron of any kind, the hoopoe and the bat. And all winged insects are unclean for you. They shall not be eaten. All clean winged things you may eat. You shall not eat anything that has died naturally. You may give it to the sojourner who is within your towns, that he may eat it, or you may sell it to a foreigner, for you are a people holy to the Lord your God. You shall not boil a young goat in its mother's milk. And we'll pause our reading there after verse 21 of Deuteronomy chapter 14. Now, reading about the food laws that God gave to Israel might seem a little bit foreign to us. We're used, at least in the Western world, to living in a context where really there are no absolute restrictions on what we can eat. We've already seen in Deuteronomy the restriction against eating blood. That's a very foundational principle in the Old Testament, not just in the law given through Moses, but also in Genesis chapter 9, after the flood. God says to Noah and to Noah's family that they are not to eat meat with blood in it. And that carries on into the Old Testament law. It was also a restriction that the apostles and elders in Jerusalem put whenever they agreed that the Gentiles did not have to follow the law of Moses in the book of Acts. They did say that they should refrain from eating meat with blood in it. And many would say that still is a universal command of God, that is a prohibition that is even binding for us as Christians today. Although I do know Christians who will eat blood in the form of black pudding, for example, in the in this part of the world. So in the UK, where I live, there are certain meats that we don't really eat, and we would turn our noses up at the idea of eating them, like horse meat, for example, or snails. These are things that the French will eat, but British people tend not to eat. But my wife is from the Chinese culture, and of course, depending on the part of China, there are many things there that they would eat that we don't eat either. Entrails and chicken feet are the ones that come to my mind first and foremost. But there's no particular reason why in my culture we don't eat them. It's just a matter of familiarity and cultural preference. But for the Israelites, there were strict rules about what they should not eat. And those are summarized for us here in Deuteronomy 14 with regards to three groups of animals. The Old Testament tends to group animals or group creatures in terms of the environment in which they live, either on the land or in the water or in the sky. And so, for example, you have bats listed amongst the animals of the sky. They're sounds like they're being listed as birds, and we would say, well, they're not birds, they're actually mammals. But the Old Testament is not, it's not that they're scientifically ignorant or that they don't know the difference. It's simply that the categories are different from the categories that modern science would use to classify animals. Amongst the animals that live on the land, well, there is a group of animals that are allowed to be eaten, and those are animals that part the hoof and has a hoof cloven in two and chews the cud. So, of course, there's a whole category of animals that are predators that aren't herbivores. Those animals that eat meat are already off the agenda. They're not to be eaten. But amongst the animals that eat grass and herbs and vegetables and so on, it is the animals that have a cloven hoof and chew the cud that are clean. That is seen as the normal type. And I think that's what's happening in these passages. I remember a few years ago, I used to teach a module on world religions in the college where I taught. And we used to invite the rabbi in, the local rabbi. He was an Orthodox rabbi, and he took the food laws very seriously. And in the question and answer time, my students, one of them asked him, do you think the laws, the food laws, are to do with hygiene and to do with preventing the spread of diseases? And that's certainly an idea that I had heard whenever I was a younger Christian, people trying to suggest, well, pigs are animals that are able to carry diseases that can also infect human beings. Even today, we're aware of swine flu, for example. And so we shouldn't eat those animals because there's a risk to our health. And the rabbi's answer really struck me. It was really quite dramatic for me, rather, in that moment, because he simply turned around and said, well, really, I don't know, and I'm not really interested in that question. For me, it's very simple. God has said that I should do this or I shouldn't do this, and I will do it or I won't do it. I found that striking. I found it challenging because, as Christians living in the modern world after the so-called Enlightenment of the 1800s, we've been encouraged to question everything and to look for a reason for everything. And of course, that pursuit of reasons and understanding has borne immense fruit in the fruits of science and technology. We can be very thankful for that. The beginnings of that were very much inspired by Christian faith, by a confidence that God's world has order and that our minds are capable of understanding it. So I don't want to take away from that at all. That's a great truth. But there's a risk that we lose some of the simplicity of faith that says, well, even when I cannot see a reason, or when no reason is given to me, I will obey. So a faithful Israelite wouldn't have been concerned to ask, well, why does an animal have to have a cloven hoof and chew the cud? They weren't concerned about whether that was for their health or not. It was a simple mark of obedience to God. And I think we need to accept that as regards the food laws. Again, some people will say, well, it's because these food laws separated Israel from the nations around them. Most of their meat was offered to false gods, and this was a way of keeping the Israelites away from that influence. But of course, the Israelites were not supposed to live amongst those people. They were supposed to drive those people out of the land, to possess that land alone for themselves. And so they wouldn't have been influenced by those practices if they had done that. But it's not simply, I mean, there is clearly some indication in this passage that we've just read that there are some things that may be about a distinction from the religious practices of the Canaanites. I think that's most likely in verses 1 and 2, when it says, you shan't cut yourself or make any baldness on your foreheads for the dead. Those seem to have been rituals that were part of the worship of the Canaanite people, a superstition and a way of trying to gain some favor or a better life for their departed loved ones. Of course, that's not something that we can do and that we should do. It's not something that God's people should do. God is Lord over life and death. He is the judge of the departed. He is the one who will, he's the one who we are accountable to. And so practices like that, which are to do with favour for the dead or superstition or mutilation of self in the hope of manipulating something in the spiritual world, are not to be followed by God's people. Again, the command at the very end of the passage, which stands alone, "You shall not boil a young goat in its mother's milk." Some will suggest that that was to do with a religious practice that the Israelite or the Canaanite nations were engaged in, that Israelites were not to follow, although there's no real clue to that in the passage, and I'm not sure that there's any separate historic or archaeological evidence for that. But in terms of the groups of animals that can be eaten, well, those that the land animals, it's those with cloven hooves that chew the cud. That's the normal pattern. And so any animal that departs from that normal in either respect, those that chew the cud but don't have a cloven hoof, there are some that depart from that that don't, or rather have a cloven hoof, that they're not allowed to eat from the camel, the hare, the rock badger, because they chew the cud but do not part the hoof. So those are the animals that they are not allowed to eat. And then for the pig, because it parts the hoof, it has a cloven hoof, but does not chew the cud. So basically, those are the restrictions. The animals that they can eat are the animals that don't have a cloven hoof and chew the cud, with the exception of the animals that are listed that do have cloven hooves and that do and that chew the cud. So that's the camel, the hare, the rock badger, because they don't part the hoof. So the pig, on the other hand, doesn't chew the cud, but does part the hoof. So I'm not sure I'm explaining that terribly well, but it's simply to say that what seems to be behind that is that there is a normal pattern of animal, and there are exceptions to that, but the normal pattern is what establishes cleanness for eating. Similarly, in the water, the normal pattern is that creatures that live in the water have fins and scales, and those are the animals that they can eat, but those that don't have fins and scales, they cannot eat. So that would include shellfish and so on. And similarly with birds, the birds that they're not to eat here, the issue seems to be that those that scavenge or feed on other birds. So just as they're not to eat land animals that eat other animals, so they're not to eat birds that eat on the flesh of other birds or animals, whether that's birds of prey that eat live birds and animals, or whether it's scavenging birds like vultures and so on. And winged insects, presumably because they too feed on the dead bodies, or at least many of them feed on the dead bodies of animals. Now, in the more extensive food laws that are given in Leviticus chapter 11, we read there from verse 20 onwards about winged insects, that there were some kinds of insects that they were allowed to eat. So if it was a winged insect that goes on all fours, they can be eaten if their legs are jointed above their feet, with which to hop on the ground. So that means locusts and grasshoppers, and that is significant because John the Baptist, you might remember, ate locusts, and you might have thought, well, doesn't Deuteronomy say that they're not to eat insects? But those kinds of insects were specifically excluded from the restriction. So then in Deuteronomy, back to Deuteronomy 14 in verse 21, we have a final restriction on what things they can eat, and that is anything that has died naturally. They're not to eat that. Sojourners among them from other nations can eat those things, but they are not to eat those things. And that, I think most likely, is because the blood must be drained out of the animal when it's still alive, or when it has just died. The kosher practice of butchering, and it's true in Muslim countries too, that the way of slaughtering for halal involves removing the blood. And of course, if that is not done straight away, the blood begins to clot in the body. So most likely, I think that's a way of making sure they don't eat blood. But again, it's a command of God. These food laws are, again, reminders that worship of God and faithfulness to him is all-encompassing. They don't apply to Christians today. We're told that explicitly in Mark chapter 7, verse 19, that Jesus declared all foods clean, not directly, but by the way he talked about what it is that makes a person clean or unclean. Those food laws were given for Israel for a time in the history of God's salvation, and as God set them apart from the nations, they're not binding on us today, they were vitally important for the nation of Israel. As was the practice of tithing, which is what we turn to next as we return to our reading in Deuteronomy 14, verse 22. You shall tithe all the yield of your seed that comes from the field year by year. And before the Lord your God, in the place that he will choose to make his name dwell there, you shall eat the tithe of your grain, of your wine, and of your oil, and the firstborn of your herd and flock, that you may learn to fear the Lord your God always. And if the way is too long for you, so that you are not able to carry the tithe, when the Lord your God blesses you because the place is too far from you, which the Lord your God chooses to set his name there, then you shall turn it into money and bind up the money in your hand and go to the place that the Lord your God chooses and spend the money for whatever you desire, oxen or sheep or wine or strong drink, whatever your appetite craves. And you shall eat there before the Lord your God, and rejoice, you and your household. And you shall not neglect the Levite who is within your towns, for he has no portion or inheritance with you. At the end of every 3 years, you shall bring out all the tithe of your produce in the same year, and lay it up within your towns. And the Levite, because he has no portion or inheritance with you, and the sojourner, the fatherless, and the widow who are within your towns, shall come and eat and be filled, that the Lord your God may bless you in all the work of your hands that you do. We'll pause there at the end of Deuteronomy 14. Here this practice of tithing is explained. It's for the benefit of the Levites, maintaining their system of service of God in the holy places. They were the ones who maintained the temple or the tabernacle before there was a temple. But it's also to do with the sojourners and the fatherless and the widow. It's a kind of welfare state. But it's also a reminder of their trust in God. This practice of tithing and bringing their tithe to the temple, to the place that God chooses, or if they can't bring the resources themselves because they're either too bulky, they're not able to carry them, or they won't stay fresh, then they can turn it to money and buy items in the place that God appoints. Deuteronomy chapter 15, then, verse 1. At the end of every 7 years, you shall grant a release. And this is the manner of the release. Every creditor shall release what he has lent to his neighbour. He shall not exact it of his neighbour, his brother, because the Lord's release has been proclaimed. Of a foreigner you may exact it, but whatever of yours is with your brother, your hand shall release. But there will be no poor among you, for the Lord will bless you in the land that the Lord your God is giving you for an inheritance to possess. If only you will strictly obey the voice of the Lord your God, being careful to do all this commandment that I command you today. For the Lord your God will bless you as he promised you, and you shall lend to many nations, but you shall not borrow, and you shall rule over many nations, but they shall not rule over you. If among you one of your brothers should become poor in any of your towns within your land that the Lord your God is giving you, you shall not harden your heart or shut your hand against your poor brother, but you shall open your hand to him and lend him sufficient for his need, whatever it may be. Take care lest there be an unworthy thought in your heart, and you say, the seventh year, the year of release, is near, and your eye look grudgingly on your poor brother, and you give him nothing, and he cry to the Lord against you, and you be guilty of sin. You shall give to him freely, and your heart shall not be grudging when you give to him, because for this the Lord your God will bless you in all your work and in all that you undertake, for there will never cease to be poor in the land. Therefore, I command you, you shall open wide your hand to your brother, to the needy and to the poor in your land. If your brother, a Hebrew man or a Hebrew woman, is sold to you, he shall serve you for 6 years, and in the seventh year you shall let him go free from you. And that when you shall let him go free from you, you shall not let him go empty-handed. You shall furnish him liberally out of your flock, out of your threshing floor, and out of your winepress. As the Lord your God has blessed you, you shall give to him. You shall remember that you were a slave in the land of Egypt, and the Lord your God redeemed you. Therefore I command you this day. But if he says to you, I will not go out from you, because he loves you and your household, since he is well off with you, then you shall take an awl and put it through his ear into the door, and he shall be your slave forever. And to your female slave you shall do the same. It shall not seem hard to you when you let him go free from you, for at half the cost of a hired servant he has served you for 6 years. So the Lord your God will bless you in all that you do. All the firstborn males that are born of your herd and flock you shall dedicate to the Lord your God. You shall do no work with the firstborn of your herd, nor shear the firstborn of your flock. You shall eat it, you and your household, before the Lord your God, year by year, at the place that the Lord will choose. But if it has any blemish, or if it is lame or blind, or has any serious blemish whatever, you shall not sacrifice it to the Lord your God. You shall eat it within your towns. The unclean and the clean alike may eat it, as though it were a gazelle or a deer. Only you shall not eat its blood. You shall pour it out on the ground like water. I will end our reading there at the end of Deuteronomy chapter 16. This principle of the seven-year release, the sabbatical year, is a wonderful principle that God worked into his law for Israel. As they were to live together as a nation, there was to be this reset button. Of course, every 7 times 7 years, there was to be a jubilee year. Leviticus 25 tells us about that. But every 7 years was this wonderful moment of reset, when slaves are set free and debts are cancelled. In other words, no Israelite is to remain poor. So the law recognises that some may become poor. There should never be someone poor amongst you. On one hand, because God will bless the nation if they're faithful to him, so they won't have natural disasters that make people poor. But when people become poor through other circumstances, mismanagement or illness or disability, then there is to be a fresh start, a new hope for them. The inheritance of the land apportioned to families is going to be maintained, so land has to go back to the family that originally inherited it, and debts must be cancelled. Now, when I mention slavery, of course, some modern ears will prick up and say, does the Bible condone slavery? And we need to recognise in the Old and New Testaments, there are two different kinds of slavery. In the New Testament, it's the Roman practice of slavery, which was not too dissimilar from modern versions of slavery, the transatlantic slave trade. It didn't have the racial aspects of that. Slaves could come from any skin colour or race, but they were often taken as prisoners in wars, or raided from countries and traded across the Roman Empire. And the master could treat them really as the master saw fit. So it was a brutal system where if you had an unkind master, they had really the right of life and death over you. And the New Testament has a lot to say about that kind of slavery. Paul, the apostle, in 1 Corinthians lists slave trading amongst sins. So trading in slaves is clearly wrong. He tells slaves to find their freedom if they can. They should be set. They should seek to earn their freedom or get it if they can. He told Christians like Onesimus, whose slave Philemon had run away, to receive Philemon, who was now a Christian, back into his home as a brother, not as a slave. And so I think the New Testament amongst Christians forbids the practice of slavery. And over time, Christians would bring about the end of slavery within the Roman Empire once they had the numerical power to do so. But for those who are slaves and cannot get their freedom, then they are commanded by Paul and by Peter to submit to their masters. The priority is to win souls for God's kingdom and to live faithfully for God, not to bring about a social revolution. But the seeds of the end of that cruel form of slavery are there in the New Testament. And Christians brought that about in the Roman Empire. Sadly, when it came to the African slave trade, some through racist really ideologies came to see those Africans as less than fully human and didn't give them those same rights. And slavery came about again with Europeans involved in it. But again, it was Christians who campaigned to do away with that practice because they recognised the New Testament did not allow it. But the practice of slavery in the Old Testament, at least in Israel, is different. It's not a practice where one person can own another person, but actually it's a practice of indentured service where a person can sell themselves into the service of another person. That's the footnote in verse 12, where it says a Hebrew man or a woman is sold to you. The footnote says, or sells himself to you. So it is a way of providing work and security for those who find themselves in poverty. It's much more akin in our world to being an employee on a contract, because there is a contract. It's time limited. He can only serve for 6 years, and in the seventh year, the year of Sabbath, he must be set free. And it's not only that, when he is set free, he must be given the means, a liberal furnishing, verse 14, the means to survive and to set up his household again in independence. So this form of slavery, if you want to call it that, is not someone being captured. It's not about possession of the person. It's not about owning them and owning the produce of their hands, but it is about giving them security for a period of time until they're able to live independently again. Unless they choose not to live independently, if they choose to continue in your household as a slave, then they have the right to do that. And you must mark it. And we hear that about the all, putting a hole through the ear of the slave. That makes it sound brutal. But actually, that was a sign that marked the commitment of the owner, the master, to make sure he continued to employ and provide for that slave. He will be your slave forever. And in fact, it was the slave who had the right to demand that. It was a right for the slave. So the master would have to provide for that slave, even if he became unable to work in future. So there is actually protection for people. People are treated with dignity. It's not at all like the modern slave trade, the transatlantic slave trade, or even modern day slavery that still exists in our world. But also there is, in this chapter, chapter 15, this requirement about devoting the firstborn male of the herd and flock to God. God is the one who is to be worshipped in all things. People have dignity under God's law as well. And so there has to be provision. We are not to spare, or they are not to spare their hands or shut their hearts against people who are poor. There's to be a compassion and a provision. So verses 7 to 11 are truly radical. Open wide your hand to your brother. Open it wide. Be generous. Share. Give generously to those in need. These are the kinds of principles, of course, that carry on even into our legal system today. But in the ancient world, those were truly radical. This is not a dog-eat-dog world where the rich get richer and the poor get poorer, but it is a world where all are treated with dignity, provided for, protected in law, and God is seen as the one who has liberated his people from slavery in Egypt so that they can live freely in relationship with him. It's a truly remarkable and wonderful sign of God's justice, his fairness, and his grace, generosity, giving, not looking grudgingly, as verse 9 puts it, on the poor brother and giving him nothing, when the seventh year comes around, rather to give freely and not to begrudge what we give, because God is the one we trust in to provide for us. What a wonderful principle, what a wonderful sign of God's grace.